This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Poet Ernest Hilbert collaborated with two Philadelphia musicians and songwriters, Dave Young and Mark Hildenberger, on a spoken word project called Elegies and Laments. They made a musical soundtrack using instruments, old recordings, and found sounds for Hilbert's book of poems, 60 Sonnets. Here's On the 25th Anniversary of John Lennon's Murder, read by Hilbert.
On a step behind the Holiday Inn, two Russians roamed up, bummed a cigarette, while a third snuck up, struck me from behind. I sprawled to asphalt, then the boot came in. I swung through the red, but it's a good bet I didn't land one. The blackout was kind. I woke, knotted in blood-ruined sheets, startled, smashed, stamped, splintered into a numbed dazzle. I spat black wads into the fuzzy sink. One look in the mirror, my brain curdled. I propped in the shower stall. Steam sizzled. My hair loosened a sick swirl of sour pink. They made off, grinning, with all I had. $2, 5 cigarettes, my Zippo.
Ernest Hilbert is a Philadelphia-based poet with a new book of poems called All of You on the Good Earth. He was born in the city, grew up in New Jersey, studied at Oxford University, and now lives back in Philadelphia and joins us on Radio Times. And Ernest Hilbert, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
So whose idea was it to put your poems to music?
It's one of those projects that wasn't just on a back burner. It almost didn't exist for about 20 years.
Really?
When I was young, I attended Rutgers University with Mark Hildenberger. And as you do when you're young, you have big ideas, but you don't have the wherewithal or the experience or the resources to really fulfill them. So we just spent hours and days talking about these albums we wanted to make. And then we sort of, over the years, drifted apart. Thanks to the miracle of Facebook, we wound up getting back together. And we were out for a drink to catch up. And he said, "Remember that album?" And I said, "Sure." He was in a Philly band called the Gray Jacks with Dave Young. I went to see them at World Cafe Live. It turned out to be their last performance. They were breaking up. So they were looking for new projects. And we said, well, why not go headlong into such a crazy thing as this? And it became much more ambitious than we had at first envisioned.
You have been a musician. Didn't you have a band in maybe high school or college? Or
sure. I was in heavy metal bands.
There
I had the
go.
Long hair. I flipped my hair around on the stage. And I also played classical music in high school. And my father was a high school music teacher who was steeped in the classical tradition and was himself, he grew up working class and went to college on the GI Bill. He was in the Second World War. So I grew up with classical music around me all the time, but rock was my thing. Until I got older, now I appreciate the classical music more.
So. I read that you read this poem on the 25th anniversary of John Lennon's murder something like 80 times for this this project.
That's right. Dave Young is an excellent producer, and like most producers, as you may well know, he's a perfectionist and a bit of a sadist, I think. And I just thought, I can't do this. If I can't get this right, that was the very first one we tried. I thought, I'm no good in the studio. But with his help, we gradually attained the level that he was looking for.
What was he looking for, do you think?
A dramatic emphasis that maybe had to be brought even further out of the poem than it was already there. A level that exists more clearly in performance than just on the page.
So did that make it a different poem for you, not only reading it all those times, but also then when you mix in the music, does it feel like your words are different?
No, it's just more emphasis, and it's a new dimension to the existing work of art, I would say.
What's interesting on some of these pieces, and we hear just a touch of this in that particular reading, is found sounds and old, what sounds like maybe radio recordings or old record recordings kind of mixed in almost to set the stage.
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of Foley artist work that he turns out to be very good at as well. Setting up a scene and then creating music that floats that scene up into more of a work of art rather than just a scenario or a vignette. And so, yes, we had archival recordings of classic poets to set a tone in a particular sequence. There's four sections on the album.
Yes.
He took a little plastic transistor radio and rewired it and then put microphones across a big room and then put them all together through that with static and radio squelches to create a sense of just a cheap old radio that's distant and is very lo-fi. And that's in mono. And then the moment the music comes in, it switches to stereo. And when you listen to it on the record with headphones, mm-hmm. it suddenly blooms out into this big, beautiful sound.
And we should say that there is a record of this. Mm-hmm. You have to play it at 45, but there is I saw it. It's a white record.
Right. That's the limited edition, 1 of 100 white vinyl. And it's 180 gram, 12-inch, 45 RPM. So you can't, by law, put more sound onto a disc than that.
Oh, wow.
And it sounds great. We also have a CD, and you can stream it and get it digitally from all major services and platforms.
Well, let me play another of your poems. This is The Fugitive Spends Christmas in Las Cruces Motel Room. In a Las Cruces
right.
Motel Room. First of all, tell us a little bit about this poem, and then we'll listen.
Well, the critic Levi Stahl described these as noir fantasies. Poetic noir fantasies, and I think he nailed it right on the head. And so the language is very rich and a bit outrageous, the way a noir novel or movie might be, in order to conjure the sensation of a mood. And so this is the second half of a two-part sequence. It begins with a liquor store robbery and an escape, and this is the woman, and she has lost her boyfriend. He's died in the attempt to rob the liquor store, and she's left in the sense that she's now, because of the choices she made, cut off from society. She's alone. Maybe they're not even really looking for her, but she's alone in this room. No one left to call. She's run out of money. It turned out they got very little money when it comes down to it, out of such a terrible thing, choice they made to sort of turn their life off the course that it was on. And you get the sense it's very sad and it's a dead end.
Let's listen. This is The Fugitive Spends Christmas in a Las Cruces Motel Room.
Stale tamales for breakfast with pale tea. Cool daybreak fires over the bronzed valley. Grizzled pink tatters down the jet-flaked blue. The cruel moon curves and makes chaos of the sea, sways around again to drag night from me. Time has ground me sharp, but I know I'm through. He's in a mound of stones in Chaparral. We didn't get much cash. It's nearly gone. Life is gathered closer here, and death, too. I'm sad, and I have no one left to call. I peek through blinds, sit on the bed alone. These kind blue pills burn me up and make me new. I'm wasted and true. Savage, coarse and far. Winter smooths me away like an old scar.
Again, that's our guest, poet Ernest Hilbert, reading a poem, The Fugitive Spends Christmas at a Las Cruces Motel Room. And the music composed and performed, Dave Young, Mark Hildenberger, a spoken word project called Elegies and Laments. Listening to you, your voice, and also reading your poems and reading this whole project here, it seems you're a storyteller as a poet. Do you think of yourself that way?
Sure. I mean, I create characters. Both the books are populated by many characters. I use the 14-line sonnet-like poem to essentially tell short stories. Some simply create a sense of a certain emotion or what have you, but often I rely on telling the mm-hmm. story through bits and pieces. And I tell it through many different characters. So it's first, second, and third person, male and female, old and young, rich and poor. And I try to, perhaps some of these are versions of myself over the years that I have shed. in an almost therapeutic method by putting them into the poems and then putting them into the book and getting them out there away from myself.
And these poems come from a collection that you wrote a couple of years ago, 60 Sonnets. And each of these, I guess the idea was an hour's worth of poetry in each,
right.
each poem about 60 seconds.
Right. I mean, Alicia Stallings, A.E. Stallings, a recent MacArthur Genius Award winner, she's the one who first described it as the meditation in 60 minutes. Each one takes about a minute to read, and it's about the minutes of an hour.
Yeah.
And I liked that so much. I went with that and realized that that was a very appropriate way of describing the book.
So, we were talking before going on the air, and Frank, there are many things that I like about your poetry, but one is that the poems are short, and frankly, as a radio host, that works for us.
Sure. Well, I guess they're radio-friendly, and a friend of mine said they're like punk songs. They come on, they roar through, and then they're done, and it gets through very quickly, and then you do the next one.
Yeah.
And it's
not
all,
that it's that simple.
Not at all. I mean, it's a great deal of concision to get, or compression, rather, to get a lot of material and a lot of words that I want to put on the page down to just the absolutely necessary ones. So it's never a matter that I'm taking two or three lines of thought and trying to tease out 14 lines. It's always the case that I'm taking a much longer poem, maybe a 3-minute poem, and pushing it down and compressing the coal down to, I wouldn't want to call them diamonds, but something that's very much more compact and easier to convey to an audience. People can get a lot in 1 minute. I mean, you can carry a lot of information in 1 minute.
And do you like that process? It's at least one of the ways that I think of poetry, which is to sort of winnowing down an image, a thought, a person to its most kind of essential language.
Right. Well, it ought to be. But I know there are many different approaches. I mean, there's subtractive art, which is taking a block of marble and chipping it down, which is what I do. But there's also additive art, where you take the clay and build it up to be a form. And I'm sure plenty of poets do that. And so this is just what works best for me, possibly because I'm so verbose.
Are you?
And enthusiastic. I tend to overfill the cup. And then I need to sort of, pull it back down. So it's something that is more amenable to a reader, to radio, to what have you. And when I read them, I try to put so much into them that I would be exhausted personally if I tried to read for longer than a minute at a stretch. That's my limitation.
but is that, we're almost up in a break here, that process then of winnowing it down, does that feel painful as someone who describes himself as verbose?
Not at all.
Likes language, I guess.
No. I mean, one of the parts of becoming an artist is learning to just let things go, because you are fertile enough to just keep producing more and more. And you don't feel like, I made this, I have to hold on to it. That's the way I was when I was young. Now I feel, I have much more confidence. I'm going to write so much more. I can take that out. Or sometimes you'll take it out and reuse it 3 years later in a different context, and it makes sense. So you have to just chip those pieces away. And, it's not just the cutting room floor. You can use them again. But I find it more comforting than anything to realize that I have pushed everything down to its most concise level.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our guest. The poet Ernest Hilbert is our guest today on Radio Times. He has a spoken word project called Elegies and Laments, mixing some of his poems with musical instruments and old recordings and found sounds. He also has a new book of poetry, All of You on the Good Earth. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Sony Classics, The Company You Keep, a new thriller directed by and starring Robert Redford, with Shia LaBeouf and Susan Sarandon, about one man's journey to outrun the FBI and his radical past, starts Friday.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra performs the music of Johannes Brahms. Donald Runicles conducts Brahms' Second Symphony, and Jonathan Biss plays Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 13. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or online, philorc.org. April 25th, 26th, and 27th at the Kimmel Center, Mozart and Brahms with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Terry Gross. Join me Sunday afternoon, May 5th, at the McCarter Theater in Princeton for Off Air with Fresh Air. I'll talk about my adventures hosting Fresh Air, play clips of interviews in which things didn't exactly go as expected, and then you could give me a taste of my own medicine during the Q&A. There will be more to see than just me. We'll have animations by WHYY's digital artist-in-residence, Tony Off. For information, visit whyy.org/events. Widener supports WHYY. A graduate degree from Widener University is designed to help be the difference in your career. Widener University offers graduate degrees in programs including hospitality and tourism and more. Registration at widener.edu/graduate.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. If you're just joining us, Ernest Hilbert is our guest. He's a poet, a rare book dealer. He writes librettos, he hosts a blog, and he's worked as an editor and a critic and lives here in the city where he was born, in Philadelphia. And we've been playing some selections from his new spoken word album. It's called Elegies and Laments. And this is a poem called Church Street. Let's listen.
The age demanded an image of its accelerated grimace.
Blackbird.
No! Bluebird!
Branch. Still jumping.
I'm safely.
Peanut-crunching crowd shoves in to see them unwrap me hand and foot. The big strip teeth.
I'll go into eversradio.com for more information about it. And I thought I'd play some songs about poets and lyrics that definitely evoke poetry.
My friends quietly dropped out of high school. It seemed each week we had parties for some guy going into jail or getting released. It's not that anyone thought this was cool. Only good wishes that the time would fly, and after 20 beers, he might find some peace. Now that I look back, with no emotion, we needed parties. We liked company. We hardly needed a reason at all. Never sweet 16 or graduation, but funeral, fresh hitch in the army, baby soon for the sad girl in the hall. We'd vent, catch any reason not to grieve, revel down days torn from the years we'd leave.
Again, that's Church Street from Ernest Hilbert's new spoken word album, Elegies and Laments. There is so much going on in that piece that we just heard. Let me begin with the voices in the beginning. Of course,
sure.
There's Sylvia Plath with that devastating poem about her father. We hear her her angry, bitter voice.
That's actually Lady Lazarus, which is a poem about sort of the self-immolating woman. but it begins with Ezra Pound. Then it goes through, that's Jack Kerouac doing one of his jazz things with the saxophone. Then, of course, Sylvia Plath, and then my friend Keith Kelleher, who hosts a show on WDIY, Lehigh Valley NPR affiliate.
Oh, sure.
And he has had me on a few times and played some of my stuff.
And that's he's saying Everse Radio.
And he's telling people to go over to my blog, yeah. So.
And then we hear your voice, and then we hear this music underneath that poem.
It's very lush. That is what I call the heavy metal symphony. And it's a layering of many guitars, many basses with effects, including this strange thing called a ring modulator that uses magnetic waves to pull the bass strings up. And it sounds, well, it's reminiscent of Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, Metallica, the soundtrack to my youth, my disaffected youth on Church Street in Mount Holly, New Jersey. And the sort of, those were the people I hung around with, and those were the parties I went to. And they were, there was always a bit of bitterness and anger and regret and self-defeating behavior, if you will, in that scene. And that was my attempt to capture that without being nostalgic about it.
Mm, my friends quietly dropped out of high school.
You didn't know it. There was no big deal about that. There's just one day they weren't there, and you ran into them again, and they'd be pumping gas and say, oh, yeah, I dropped out. Mm. It was no big deal. And their parents did, too.
And their parents are too, and as you say, are going into jail or getting released. Never sweet 16 or graduation, funerals, babies.
There were, that's exactly what it was. You'd have parties for people because they were about to go in the hole or because they were coming out of jail. And you'd have parties because someone was going in the army or they just got out. I mean, those were the parties that I found myself at. So,
But you're right here, we needed parties. We needed parties.
Oh, yeah. I use the word vent in
company.
There.
We liked company. Yeah, vent.
And
heavy
metal was a form of venting. And all the drinking was a type of venting. And the fighting and all those things were ways of just letting it out.
And this was Mount Holly, New Jersey.
This was Mount Holly, New Jersey. Yeah.
And you were one of these kids.
I was, yeah.
And how come you didn't end up in jail?
Because I did once. That's in one of the poems, too. But let's not dwell on that.
I didn't keep you too long,
I also went to Oxford. So, because I had a loving family. And they really always were there for me. And even when I screwed up, I could come home. And that was there for me.
Right.
And that's why. It's because of my family.
So why did you end up in jail?
I can't talk about that on the air, can I?
You can't. I don't know.
It was just for a night. It's just for a night. It was minor. I didn't go to prison. I was in jail.
Yeah. Gotcha. But interesting. I mean, it's interesting you said that you had a loving family. Do you think, I mean, not to be too psychological here, but do you think that's why your path different from these kids?
Absolutely.
In your poem?
Oh, there's no question about it. No question about it. I hear men talk about how much they hate their fathers all the time. And all ages, even at my age, they still talk about it that way. And I never, ever felt that way. I've always loved my father. He passed away in the 90s, but I always loved him. There was never that tension. I loved my mother and my sisters and my brother. And we were a very good family. Right. A little
and
weird.
Weird's okay.
Yeah, we were a bizarre clan. But we loved each other. And that is very precisely why I think I'm doing okay now.
And why were you a bizarre clan?
Well, I think I have a poem, Pirates, in which I talk about that.
Yes.
Pirates have been big for a few years now, partly because of Johnny Depp. And then you have Talk Like a Pirate Day and all that. And I thought, well, this is not about Buccaneers per se, but it's about what would the, if you're raising the black flag on a suburban house, the Jolly Roger, and say, we are separate, we are outside of your daily commerce and your rules. That was my family. So I can read the poem.
That would be great. And let me just say to our listeners, this is from your new book of poetry, All of You on the Good Earth, and a poem called Pirates.
That's right. This is Pirates for Jennifer Mikowski. Impatiently polite. Imperious. Our neighbors only just tolerated the peculiar clan at cul-de-sac's end. We were insufficiently industrious with lawn care. And our plot was at last rated an eyesore. How, they wondered, could we spend so much time sleeping, so little weeding? Crabgrass spiked brown, dandelions spackled gold. Of an old German barbarian born, a sour, thin kid, moping, slouching, reading. I'd gather bruised windfall apples and throw them over the hedge, broadside launched with scorn from our blue-shingled brigantine, square prow lodged in high grass, underneath long boughs.
I really like that poem. I put a post-it in there.
Oh, good.
That's a poem, Pirates, read by our guest, Ernest Hilbert, from his new collection of poems called All of You on the Good Earth. So you were one of those families other families talked about.
They thought, oh, no. Yeah, of course. And it was a cul-de-sac. We were right at the dead end, right. If you want
with
to
all the
that.
Dandelions and the
that's
high
right.
weeds.
That's right. Yeah, the grass always got a bit long and sort of... Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that was it. But we were good people. We're really friendly people. We just were not into keeping up appearances in quite the same way.
And would people come and knock on your door and say, why don't you mow your lawn?
I think my mom would have better memories of that. I'm sure there were comments. Mm-hmm. I'm absolutely certain there were comments, yeah.
You mentioned that your dad was a musician. He was an organist.
He played organ in the church and was the choir master. And, you know, he knew his Bach and he knew the big pieces and he knew how to arrange them. And he wrote music and read music. But he spent his life as a high school music teacher, which was the way he got out of his Southside German ethnic neighborhood. When, you know, he was the first to really speak very good English. And he fought in the Second World War in the Pacific. And then he was on the GI Bill of Rights. He was able to go to college. And he went to Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, took it very seriously, and then he got a job as a high school music teacher of a grand sort. I mean, he wound up with a 120-voice choir singing in Latin without sheet music, and he took them on two tours behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War in the 1970s as a sort of gesture of détente, I suppose. There was a cultural exchange program. I'm sure some Russian choirs probably came over across the pond to us. So he did a lot for a high school teacher.
Yeah. It sounds like he did a lot for you and his family
absolutely,
as well.
Absolutely.
And that music was, what, always on in
always
your house?
Always on, day and night. I still remember WFLN, classical music station here in Philly.
Rest
and
in peace, but yes.
Of course, and Sleepers Awake, and they'd play the Bartok. And I remember, you know, nights I couldn't sleep, I would hear that coming from downstairs. Literally music on at all times, radio, or he was playing records, or he was playing the piano himself.
Right.
I would wake up to him doing his Rachmaninoff and things like that. So it was, music was just in the air. I took it for granted, and I'm still that way. I listen to music all the time. I get a little crazy without it. It's just like reading. If I spend a few days I haven't had a chance to read, my brain gets very frazzled and burnt at the edges, and then I sit down and read, and it's just this cool drink of water. And so the music and the books are extraordinarily important to who I am and maintaining my happiness and sanity.
Did he also like heavy metal music, your dad?
No. He didn't even tolerate jazz. I mean, he respected it. He certainly did not like rock music. No, he was of the generation, he put on a tie to go to the grocery store. I mean, he was a different generation. He grew up in the Great Depression, and he loved classical, and he knew a great deal about it, and that's all he really wanted to hear. It's what he understood. It's what he knew. Right. So that was his salvation, was the classical music.
So when you had your band and your long hair, was he okay with that?
He was. I mean, the earliest bands I was in high school, I would sometimes practice in the basement and shake his coffee cup would move across the table. We were so loud. And he was nice to all the long-haired guys who were hanging around the house. And he was really friendly, and he'd joke with them, and they loved him. And so, no, he was always encouraging me to do anything that he saw as positive, like reading or playing music and things like that. So.
Were you a good student?
No, I was an awful student up until I went to college. I went to Rutgers University, and I really just battened down the hatches and tried really hard. I worked extremely hard at the state school, which is how I got accepted to Columbia and Oxford. Mm-hmm. I went to Oxford. But in everything from nursery school up, I was a bit of a behavior problem. Not as a bad kid. I liked to talk too much. You know, I was that sort of, a little rowdy. I understand, I respect the fact that teachers need to keep control in the classroom, but when I was young, I didn't see that.
You were just jabbering?
I was just jabbering. I was enthusiastic and, you know, always engaged in something. I have these crazy enthusiasms that take me, and I have a lot of curiosity, and so what, I'd be talking about dinosaurs or sharks or whatever. I didn't care about the algebra, so. Yeah, so I was not a bad kid, but I was a behavior problem. My grades were generally not that good. I was usually bored and not paying attention. And
that's my fault.
So
did you do your homework?
I kind of tried to, but sometimes I had headphones on with really loud music, so I didn't realize that keeps you from really doing it. You're not really absorbing anything. You're listening to the beat, you know. So I'd be listening to Slayer when I was doing my algebra, and that's why it didn't sink in.
So you obviously had good enough grades or SAT scores to get into Rutgers, but you really wanted to become more serious about learning?
Suddenly, yeah. Well, I just grew up. Well, my father died.
Oh.
And I was the oldest man in the family. And
so you felt a sense of responsibility?
Everything changed overnight. It's sort of the Prince Hal to Henry V transition, if that's not a bit too grand. But I mean, it was that sense that suddenly it's a new game now, or it's not a game. And then, you know, I went to Rutgers. I worked really, really hard and, you know, wanted to have like a 4.0 average and really struggled to overcome my lackadaisical past, and I did a lot, and I was already publishing in magazines and poems, essays, short stories. I published in science fiction magazines and horror magazines back then, but I was trying. I was always on. I was always pushing forward to sort of achieve something, or maybe impress him even when he was gone.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So a powerful presence,
sure,
in your life. And your mom?
Just as much. She is a very educated woman, and she showed me that you can pretty much do whatever you want to do, you know. And
nice.
Yeah, so, you know, I look forward to seeing her. She spends half the year in Mexico, and she's going to be back soon. So I look forward to seeing her.
Well, let me play something else from your Elegies and Laments. And I have to say, I really enjoyed this. This is Biglin Brothers Racing. Mm. And again, music and arrangements by Mark Hildenberger, Dave Young, and Christopher LaRosa.
Well, I'd like to point out that the last section of the album, which is the Elegies and Laments section,
yes.
Christopher LaRosa is a young composer. When I say young, he was probably 20 when he wrote these pieces. He came in and he took the music that Dave and Mark had written and then composed in a classical style around them, where he literally took my poems and scored them line for line as if he were scoring a movie. the way sometimes a composer will watch the movie while they're writing the music. And he did that line for line. So if you listen, his music reacts to the words and what the words are describing and how they sound.
Let's listen. This is Bigland Brothers Racing.
Nimble rowers, their art ancient as war, raise their oars and ride gently on dented gold as sun shocks the river to ribboned fire. They haul hard and halt. Nothing prepares for their clear and precise aim. They raise and fold their blades under, pull, draw, rest and respire. Simple flexed machines of doused ore, bright fleck, trained across cold surfaces brisk as steel, delicate insect thrash, more than just life, more than we allow ourselves to expect. Polished slender shell and jet-drawn keel, thrust through late noon light, fine as a knife, muscled rowers glide on their mirrored sky, winners, champions, built only to die.
And again, Bigland Brothers Racing from the spoken word album Elegies and Laments. And since we're in Philadelphia, we think of Thomas Aikens, mm-hmm. we think of the Schuylkill River,
sure.
we see rowers.
This is the second half of another one of the portmanteau poems in the book, where they're really... two poems, one following the other, that expresses something related to the one before.
Yeah.
The poem before this in the book is at the grave of Thomas Aikens. He's buried at the Woodland Cemetery, which is in my neighborhood in West Philly. And when we are visiting his grave, the Schuylkill River, which means hidden river, is literally right below you. And that's where the Bigland brothers sometimes race. That's where Aikens painted them. He did 11 portraits of them, and they were brothers who were excellent rowers and won a lot of awards. And, and I briefly rowed at Oxford as well, and I've always had a fascination with the beauty of those skulls and the men and women who move them so quickly through the water. Like they're almost superhuman, like they're something beyond human, say, insect or machine. And then the sadness in the end, which is a bit of cold water in the face, is that even such incredible achievements of humanity still, remember, I'm viewing this from the graveyard from the previous poem, which people haven't heard.
Yes.
So you're in a graveyard looking at Aikens as well as some of his subjects who are buried there. And then you see the river, and then I went into the fantasy of imagining the actual rowers. I have the painting. I think I got it at a yard sale in my office, so I've seen it, one of those paintings anyway, many times. It's literally called Bigland Brothers Racing, and they're just beautiful, like muscled machines. But in the end, everything goes, which is one of the underlying themes in both my books. I think that poetry over the years has been one of the ways in which I'm coming to terms with death, both the death of others and my own eventual death.
Sure.
And so that's why you hear those notes in these poems.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Again, Ernest Hilbert is our guest today on Radio Times. He's a poet. He has a new collection called All of You on the Good Earth and a spoken word project called Elegies and Laments. Much more after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lantern Theatre Company presents Henry V, extended through this Sunday, April 21st only. Philadelphia's own Ben Dibble takes on the title role in Shakespeare's epic journey through royal courts and battlefields. Following a bloody civil war, charismatic young King Henry sets out to repair a fractured England with a common purpose, war with France. From the rousing speeches to the dark eve of Agincourt, Henry V is a tale of raw power, punctuated by surprising moments of comedy. Information at lanterntheatre.org.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's daytime news magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture, Here and Now. Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School, with day and residential options, is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Dr. Dan Gottlieb makes a presentation at their Phoenixville campus on April 22nd, and the school hosts an open house at their Glenmore campus on April 27th. To register for the presentation on April 22nd and the open house on April 27th, and for more details, camphillspecialschool.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Ernest Hilbert. He's a poet. He's a rare book collector, or dealer, I should say. He writes librettos. He hosts a blog. He has worked as an editor and a critic. Grew up here in the Delaware Valley. And he is reading from his new book, All of You on the Good Earth. And we've been listening to some selections from Elegies and Laments. I'd love to have you read the title poem from your new collection. Maybe even set it up for our listeners.
Sure. Okay. Well, it's a bit of a sci-fi poem. It's dedicated to Henry Wessels, who is a science fiction writer and impresario and enthusiast. And what it's about, I mean, the title comes from the Apollo 8 mission, which is the first time that we successfully circumnavigated the Earth's moon. And so you know the iconic image of the Earth rising over the moon, which is bleak, and then there's this beautiful blue-green thing coming up. We're used to seeing the moon come up.
Yes.
And Captain, or rather Commander Borman, once he got radio contact again, was expected to send a message back to Earth. Bear in mind, this is 1968. The Earth is in great tumult. There's wars and conflict and division everywhere. And he sees this peaceful, placid thing in the distance. And he says it was a heartrending sight. So he didn't know what was equal to the moment. So he tried to read from the book of Genesis, and it's a bit stumbling and awkward. But then he ends it by saying, you know, Happy New Year to all of you. All of you on the good earth. Mm. And to me, it's a signal that we are all together in this, as much as we divide ourselves. The poem is a bit whimsical. It's about how science fiction writers, and by extension, people who try to prophesy the future through the Bible or astrology or statistics or any different measuring device, how they really don't know the future. And the future can suddenly go sideways in ways you had no way of preparing for. And that's why the poem ends with a sinister figure after these sort of like fun sci-fi things. And so anyway, let me go ahead and,
sure.
and read it. It's All of You on the Good Earth for Henry Wessels. Even sci-fi gurus sometimes stumble. Some small, seemingly obvious details fail to fit into far-sighted novels. Robots built to be human still fumble with decks of punch cards for brains. Other tales use cassette tapes to achieve time travel. Clerks bang on typewriters beyond the last star. Beehives and bell bottoms always stay in style. The milkman still makes rounds, but he's a clone. A hero, fleeing in a hover car, slowly spins away on a rotary dial to activate the 3D videophone. A lone man emerges from a structure. He keys a code and turns from the locked door.
Mm. Again, that's our guest, Ernest Hilbert, reading the title poem from his new book of poetry called All of You on the Good Earth. As I read it last night and as you were reading it today, I was thinking about those very cheesy sci-fi movies, looking into the future, which is always great big knobs and steering wheels.
That's
such a dated view of the future.
Right, and no one envisioned cell phones or the internet or any of these things, at least till the 80s. So it's like their future was gigantic space. It was an extension of their world. It was the Cold War. It was big machines moving around in space. That's how they saw it. So, and often I understand those science fiction novels were really about their own eras. The best ones were. I get that. Or they have a universal theme. But it's still something to remember that, you know, we always strive for a better world, but we should do so cautiously because we don't really know the effects, what the effects will be of everything we're doing. Because sometimes, and this is something that goes throughout both my books, and of course the album, is that sometimes things that seem incredibly familiar to us actually could be filled with wonder and even be frightening when we suddenly see what they are. And so, you know, you imagine a future where you're on a space station, but the women still have beehive hairdos because that man never, usually it was a man, never envisioned. He didn't
and
even
the beehive,
think,
right?
He didn't think about women's styles changing. He just thought about, you know, the big technological events that were coming. So,
why did you want to be, or why did, why did you want to be a poet?
You know, I don't know.
I understand why you do, but why did you?
Well, I hope I'm good at it. I feel that, and this might sound a bit corny, but people say, is a poet born or made? And I feel that it has to be both. You have to have an aptitude for words, for delivering those words, for wanting to play the word games, but also have a bigger picture in mind and a deeper theme as an artist. And then you have to cultivate it. You have to have the opportunities to, and even if those opportunities are closed off to you, you just have to keep going on your own and not give up. And it doesn't matter if you're an outsider. There's a lot of pride in being an outsider artist, I think. And so, not to say that I am, but I'm just saying the key is even when things don't seem to be going well or you're not accepted, to just keep going on your own terms. Learn as much as you can from others and from your mistakes and keep going. And at some point, I started seeing myself as a poet and that not as whatever job I was doing to make my money. And it's a strange designation, and it's not something that gets you a lot of attention in our society. So thank you for having me on.
Oh, absolutely.
I appreciate that.
I mean, as I said, we really enjoy talking to poets, or I personally enjoy talking to poets, and I think it works very well on the radio as well. But I'm curious about when you realized or decided, hey, I'm a poet. What, I mean, was it getting something published? Was
sure.
Was it another poet acknowledging your work?
Well, you know, W.H. Auden always said, when people asked him, you know, how do you know you're a poet? He said, the only way I know I'm a poet is when I'm literally writing a poem. He says, I never know that I'll write another one after that. And so only in the process of creating a poem, the poesis, maker, like he felt like that was the moment that he was the engineer of the words, he was a poet. To answer your question more personally, I mean, I always loved poetry when I was young and song lyrics, of course, and I was in bands and I wrote some of the lyrics, you know, and then I literally made this transition from saying, I've had enough of the band, it's driving me crazy, I'm going to start writing. And I started writing poems and short stories and fitful starts on novels, and I was mostly in genre magazines. When I was publishing poems, they were in vampire anthologies, they were in science fiction magazines, which is one of the reasons I wanted to give a nod to that. Very first poem I ever published was in a magazine called Figment, which was and it was about a space mission. It was a poem literally about a space mission. So that's how I came up. And then when do you finally feel it? I don't know. It's when other people refer to you that way. And I think it was my friend Daniel Felsenfeld, who's a composer in New York, started introducing me as
poet,
my friend, the poet. And until someone did that, it didn't feel real. So you're right. There is a sense that it needs to be publicly acknowledged, even if only by a handful of people outside of yourself, that you someone's acknowledging and recognizing that you are finally the thing that you think you are or you suspect you are.
I do want to go back to this spoken word album, Elegies and Laments. We actually pulled out, I guess it's a hidden track, I'm not sure.
It's not
semi-hidden,
a digital version. Yeah.
Hidden in plain sight. But anyway, it's called The War Correspondent. And this is our guest, Ernest Hilbert, with a reading.
Summertime. I hear gunshots from the street. The windows of my narrow apartment are open for lack of a working AC. Sometimes, hoarse threats and fast steps will precede the quick, sharp cracks. Nice trade for such cheap rent. Other times, shots bring surprise misery from silence. I dim the lights and raise Bach. Go back to my book. It is like thunder on a clear day, or black cats popping off when the fourth is a month away. The shock has worn off, lost all its vagrant wonder, even as a man dies screaming in the next lot. Who can write of such things as become clear and sane because they are so painfully near?
And again, that's our guest, Ernest Hilbert, reading a poem, The War Correspondent. Music and arrangements by Mark Hildenberger, Dave Young, and Christopher LaRosa from Elegies and Laments. Have you ever thought about being a war correspondent?
No.
Do you know war correspondents?
No, I don't. I mean, I create these characters to express something that I'm thinking. And again, I was mentioning earlier that the point of this is the things that hide in plain sight, things we don't deal with. We're all in some state of denial about something, or we wouldn't be able to get through our days. And the full title of this is actually The War Correspondent Returns to His Neighborhood. So he's been covering something in a far-flung part of the world. And we think that those things only happen over there. And then he comes home to his neighborhood in a city, and he's hearing the gunshots on his own streets. And that was, of course, my one-bedroom apartment in West Philadelphia, where we were hearing those shots. And I transferred it onto a character. And what it's about is that these things don't just happen far away all the time. They don't happen to other people or over there. They happen everywhere.
Yeah.
And that's what that poem's really about. And it's about the shock of, like, he's going to travel that far to find something. He came home, and then it's right there in front of him.
What did it mean to go to Oxford? Having been a pretty lousy student, as you described.
I tried really hard. I was always well-read. It was just a matter of not being very well-behaved. I have to say...
Were you better behaved at Oxford?
No. But they expect that. So it was. I flourished there. I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified. And the first night there, I think I sat in my room and wept. I felt so far over my head. I've been thrown into the deep end. And it made me work so hard and take things so seriously and just without a moment's pause and just going year round, you know. And it's not like I had money for vacations anyway. So, I mean, it was just always at the Bodleian Library, always working, going to lectures, you know, and also doing jobs to make money at the same time while I was there under the table. So the British government didn't know. It was a huge experience, and it really changed me completely and took me a while to get over it because I was like, oh, I can't believe I did this. This is great. And now it just seems like it's strange. It seems like distant history and also like it was just yesterday. But it introduced me to a much wider world. And when I had the Oxford Quarterly, I was able to publish. I had Nobel Prize winners on my advisory board like Seamus Heaney, and I was able to publish Pulitzer Prize winners. And I suddenly was in this new echelon where I suddenly could, at least through the mail, get contact with those people. And it gave me a big boost, made me see that you should always go for the bigger thing. And if you fail, then at least you went for the bigger thing. You know, my dad always said you could be a big fish in a small pond, or you could just go out to the ocean, you know? So get eaten by bigger fish.
Right, the words from your dad. I'd love to have you read a poem from All of You on the Good Earth, and this is one that I really like, Dusk in a Crowded Train Compartment, Regretting My Life.
Well, the title tips you off a bit that it's a bit of a joke.
Yes.
Now, I've spent a lot of time on the Northeast Corridor Express, which for those of you listening outside the area, that goes from Philadelphia up to New York. And when I was living in Philadelphia and going to see people in New York, I went that way. I was coming back to visit friends and girlfriends in Philadelphia, going that way. And now I'm going back up to New York again on it. And it's a bleak landscape that goes past you when you're out there. And I love ruins. And I love being around them. But I had a friend from Northern California who visited once and drove through there and said, I just don't know how you can live in a place like this. It seems so run down. But it's like a stabilized ruin. It functions. Anyway, here's the poem. It's sort of a dark night of the soul, a bit of a drug. It's really just a hangover. Dusk in a crowded train compartment, regretting my life. I stayed up 2 days straight with some old friends in New York and was charred, gut sick, still wired, stuck on the Northeast Corridor Express, suffering quietly as night descended. I was pressed to the window, far too tired to read, cramped by a pimpled giantess who nodded to a thump in her headphones. The wrecked landscape of North Jersey swung past, telephone poles tilted to cold shimmer of swamp, rusted scaffolds, graffitied stones, great piers rotted down into tall, slow grass. I focused on breathing like a swimmer. Late rays shocked an oil tank's silver to white. A dying flash pulled fast out of my sight.
Mm. And again, our guest, Ernest Hilbert, reading from his book of poetry, All of You on the Good Earth, Dusk in a Crowded Train Compartment, Regretting My Life. Well, I regret we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye here, and we do want to close things out with Calavera for a Friend. Mm-hmm. And again, this is from your spoken word album, Elegies and Laments. Tell us what we should be listening for.
Well, the music for this begins with an array of strings, about probably 20 or 25 players and then reduces gradually down to only one. And you should be listening for that. And it's the big theme of the album, recapitulated. Calavera for a Friend is a small sugar skull on the Day of the Dead that you consume or put on an altar as if symbolically conquering death. And it's a day you make fun of death. And when my sister, I've always read this poem to close out my sets when I do readings, and one of my sisters listened to it and said, I really like the poem about Dad. And I thought, I don't have
about
a poem
Dad.
About it. I don't have a poem about Dad. And I thought about it. By process of elimination, I realized it was this, and that the big elegy for my father was hiding in plain sight and meant so much to me and other people all these years, and I didn't even realize I had done it. So that's what this poem is. It's also about the fact that the world keeps going when you're gone, and when you die, it closes around you like a wound and just keeps going.
Well, Ernest Hilbert, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And we've been talking with a poet, rare book dealer, Ernest Hilbert. And he does have a collection, a new collection of poems, All of You on the Good Earth, Elegies and Laments, a CD that sets some of his poems to music, a soundtrack, if you will, for his poetry. And Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder produce Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane, and again, we will close things out in this hour of Radio Times. Calavera for a Friend.
When your heart is scorched out, the unruly world will seal around you as a dark ocean behind a ship at dusk. The wake will fade and spread wider until fully unfurled. Love reserved for you will slacken. Your portion of commerce ends with the last deal you made. A stranger will take your job, buy your home, maybe wear your shirts and shoes, and the books you cherished will be thumbed by new readers. Young tourists will roam everywhere you roamed. Some small items might remain, artifacts, footnotes, fingerprints, cufflinks, little anchors, small burrs that cling, initials carved in a tree, your name inscribed where no one will see.